Desafinado, Discord, is the theme music for the WPKN program on books and book publishing. I am Hans Koning, a novelist. Why are we calling the program Discord? Because we try to stay away from the endless publicity about bestsellers and million-dollar advances and celebrities who write their autobiographies with the help of somebody else, and we want to talk instead about literature. Or, not to sound too arrogant, about serious reading and serious writing. Our guest today is Esther Allen. She is the chair of the PEN Translation Committee. PEN is the Organization of Writers, Publishers, Editors, and the Translation Committee is an increasingly important part of their work.
The PEN Translation Committee is an interesting phenomenon. It's just a sort of organization of translators within PEN, which is, an organization of writers. That also includes editors and translators. And it's been around for about 40 years, and it's really been the sort of primary force in favor of translation in the United States in its own very quiet way. For example, about 12 or 13 years ago now, it was the PEN Translation Committee that convinced the Library of Congress to actually list the names of translators in its catalog so that you could pull up work by the name of the translator. Before that, you wouldn't have been able to.
Right.
And so somebody like Gregory Rabassa, for example, who translated 100 Years of Solitude and has probably given us more than 50 books, would have gone to the Library of Congress and discovered that he had made no contribution whatsoever. So that was sort of a triumph for translators in the United States. And, of course, given that the Library of Congress sets the standard, most other libraries have now fallen into place with that. And for a long time, that was kind of what the Translation Committee focused on, which was gaining recognition for translators, defending the rights of translators who are quite often sort of the weak link in the chain in terms of the way that they're treated by publishers, and just defending translation and translators in that way. And what happened recently, I'd say in the last 3 years, is that we became convinced that we had to become even more proactive and actually start defending translation itself.
Yes.
And doing what we could do to promote it and to create a circumstance within the marketplace in the United States where there could be more of it, because there were these very alarming ironies that were emerging. For example, in 2002, the United Nations Development Program published a report about the Arab world, which deplored the fact that in a language group that is composed of 280 million people, there were only about 300 translations published per year in all of those countries. And, of course, this was seized upon by various people in the U.S. media who were repeating this figure and saying, isn't this emblematic of the isolation of the Arab world and the provincialism and the way that it's just closed itself off to the rest of the globe? And I was highly amused, as were a lot of other people at the PEN Translation Committee, because, in fact, the National Endowment for the Arts did a study in 1999 of translation in the United States, which also has about 280 million people and has a publishing industry that produces more than 100,000 books a year, unlike the Arab world. I don't know how many are produced in the Arab world, but I can't imagine it's anywhere even near that. And out of those 100,000 books a year, the NEA discovered that in 1999, 297 of them were literary translations.
Oh, wow. Are you talking about novels now? Or?
I'm talking about fiction and poetry. They decided to only count fiction and poetry because after that the word literary enters a grayer area.
Yes.
And I would say that between fiction, poetry, and relevant forms of nonfiction that are not Japanese computer manuals, which obviously are also relevant in terms of sort of commerce with the rest of the world, but in terms of voices being heard from the rest of the world, I'd say that's probably about 500 or 600 books a year.
Right. Am I right in thinking you focus on translations into English and not the other way around?
Yes, that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
We're talking about translations into English.
But you don't do anything about the others.
Well, we don't need to because the marketplace is taking care of that for us. I mean, you know, American writers routinely see their books translated across the globe. That's a phenomenon that doesn't need anyone's assistance. You know, it occurs. What's not occurring is the opposite phenomenon, and people don't even seem to realize that this is something that's missing from our landscape. But when you point it out, of course, then you start looking through the New York Times book review, for example, and you say, oh, my God, this entire book review, and there's not a single book here that wasn't originally written in English.
Well, I don't quite agree with you that the marketplace will take care of translations of American novels. Yes, the big bestsellers, of course, and the household word writers, but there's a lot of serious literature that it gets very much neglected here, and thus in Europe, say, nobody even knows about it.
Well, I think that that's probably true. I mean, there are always very worthy books that get neglected, but in terms of a pressing political issue within the United States right now, I think this is much more urgent, the fact that voices from the rest of the world are simply unable to get into a market that essentially says to the entire globe, and of course the English book market is the largest book market on the globe, and for the English book market and the United States being an extreme case within the English language book market, to say to the rest of the globe, you either write in English or your chances of getting published are completely minimal, is not good.
No. Not to change the subject, heaven knows, but I want to talk for a moment about quality.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm bilingual or trilingual, and I write in English, but my novels have been translated in Dutch and in all sorts of other languages. And I'm one of the people who can judge a Dutch translation because I was born in Holland and I speak Dutch. And I am appalled at the quality of the translation of my own books. And people tell me, well, this was a first-class translator, he's done Faulkner or whatever. Nevertheless, non de plus to, sir, although translators are no longer as badly paid as they used to be, I think, and also serious books get help from the Council of the Humanities and things like that, if I'm not wrong. Still, one has a feeling that most translators really, I think sometimes they just hire a student to do a rough translation and go over it in a red pencil. That seems a terrain that is very much demands to be taken care of by your committee, I would think.
Well, it certainly is something that's of great concern. I'm surprised to hear that you were very badly translated into Dutch, because we have these illusions about European translators as being so well taken care of and so well trained and highly skilled.
No, I'm not. It's not an anecdote. I could make a long list of terrible things. For something on a slightly different thing, you know the Sartre, the Chemin de la Liberté, the trilogy,
mm-hmm.
The Roads of Freedom, whatever it's called here. I don't know how this came about, but a couple of months ago I discovered that large bits of this book were just left out in the translation into English.
Well, these are horror stories that you hear, and when it comes to translation into English, it's not really very surprising, because what's surprising actually is that there are very good translators and there are books that are published in translations that are brilliant. For example, I think we'll probably agree that the work of W.G. Sebald, as it was published in English, was quite magnificently translated, to give just one example. But the situation of a translator is a task that is so uncompensated in the United States. There are very, very few places in the country that offer training for literary translation as a sort of a separate skill in and of itself, which it very much is.
Yes.
I mean, imagine the situation of a playwright if there were no acting schools, if acting was not regarded as anything that anyone had to learn, but that anyone who could simply speak could get up on a stage and act. You know, probably most plays would be incredibly badly performed, and everyone would say, oh, well, the theater, it just doesn't work. if you see what I mean. I mean, my analogy to translation is that there's no expectation that you need to have skill or experience or knowledge in order to be a translator. And publishers have so little experience publishing translations in the English-speaking world now, especially, that they don't even know what to look for or who to look for. And, you know, quite often it'll be sort of like, oh, my brother-in-law speaks French, let's just press him into service, you know, that kind of an attitude.
Yeah.
There's no sense that this is a separate performative art that requires, you know, its own level of respect, its own compensation, a separate training. None of those things are in place, really.
No, even if a translator knows both languages very well, he still has to know a lot about the institutions and the way the society of the other language, how these functions. Otherwise, you get the most grotesque mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember reading a translation of a great classic of Mexican literature. It's called, in Spanish, it's called Hasta No Verte, Jesús Mío, which is an extremely depressing title. It gives you an image of an old woman sitting in her room getting drunk because it's a toast, and she's sort of raising a glass to the picture of Jesus on the wall and tossing it back until she's going to be blind drunk, right? And that title very accurately depicts the novel, which is by a wonderful writer named Elena Poniatowska. Well, it gets transmuted into English as, "Here's to you, Jesusa," which is sort of extremely upbeat, as if the whole novel were kind of this magnificent tribute to its main character, who happens to be named Jesusa, but that has nothing to do with the Jesus, which is masculine, of the title. And the translator that they gave it to, I felt great compassion for, because this was someone who obviously not only had never been to Mexico, but had never even eaten in a Mexican restaurant, because it included a mention of butter tamales. I mean, if you've eaten just once in a Mexican restaurant, you know that butter is not a key ingredient in Mexican food. I mean,
well, I wouldn't feel sorry for him. I would have him arrested for fraud or something.
Well, I feel sorry for them, because obviously this was somebody who was young, who was inexperienced, who was very flattered that the publisher approached them, who probably got paid almost no money for doing this, you know, probably tore her brains out. And the person that I blame in that instance is the publisher.
Well,
but I think the publishers need to become much more sophisticated and much more aware of what's involved in doing a translation and what they are actually asking people to do. They seem to think that it's something like doing a crossword puzzle,
yeah.
You know.
Is there any kind of subsidy for translation here? I forgot now.
Well, actually, the most significant source of funding for translation is, in terms of grant monies available, is from the National Endowment for the Arts. Which gives away about 10 grants of $10,000 each year, and I think recently has been stepping that up to 20 grants. We actually had a somewhat miraculous thing occur at Penn, one of these things that does not happen in life, happened, which was that when we had started our work sort of trying to promote translation itself and talking about these ironies about the Arab world and the U.S. world, the U.S. literary world and things like that, someone that none of us had ever met before came into the office one day, made an appointment, came into the office and said, "This situation with translation in the English-speaking world is really dire and we've got to do something about it, and I'm giving you $500,000 to start an endowment to support translation." And that alone was extraordinary enough, except that when the money came in, it wasn't $500,000, it was $730,000.
Oh.
So,
in small notes?
Huh?
In small notes in a suitcase?
Well, no, not quite, but it was cash transferred direct from a brokerage firm, which I'm told by people in the charitable world just never happens. And the most extraordinary thing about it of all is that the donor, who requires absolute anonymity, who will not have their name on this, is not at all a rich person. But it's someone for whom this is absolutely crucial.
That's a strange story.
And the money, the source of the money, is the most extraordinary thing of all. The donor's father was a soldier in the American Army in World War II and was killed. And the mother, when the donor was just a tiny baby, the mother received a death benefit from the American government, as is the case when these things happen. And that money was invested. It was sacred money. It was set aside. That was the father's death money, and it was never to be touched except in the most dire of emergencies, and no dire emergency ever arose, and so it never was touched. And it's now $730,000, and that's what we were given.
And you had to decide, you had to subsidize translations with it?
Yes.
Oh, that's quite a nice job to be given, no?
Well, the most amazing thing was that the money is to form an endowment, so we can only give away the interest each year, but already that allows us to give away around $30,000, which is, it's a beginning anyway.
How much does a average, not very popular, just an average novel, say from French into English, how much would you more or less expect to be paid as a translator of French into English?
Well, you see, that's very, very hard to say because... let me put it this way. Would you want to be paid the same amount for translating a novel by Hemingway as you'd be paid for translating a novel by Faulkner? If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
The difficulties of a given translation depend, especially if it's a literary translation, really depend on the text, you know, very individual qualities within the text. But certainly the rates of pay, I mean, translators just try very hard not to think about the rates at which they're paid, because if you worked it out to an hourly wage, it would be way, way below minimum wage. So, I mean, it's not unusual for somebody to be paid, you know, $5,000 to translate a whole novel, which is what Gregory Rabassa was paid 30 years ago to translate 100 Years of Solitude, and it's still the going rate, and it takes you, I can tell you, I've done it, it takes you at least 6 months to translate a whole novel and do it well.
Yes. I'm talking to Esther Allen, who is the chair of the Penn Translation Committee. You're listening to Literary Discord. I'm Hans Koning. Esther, I want to describe one case history to you and see what you have to say about it. Do you remember when Pasternak got the Nobel Prize for Dr. Zhivago and then was forbidden to go and get it? And there was sort of a enormous brouhaha started. Who would come out first with an English translation?
Uh-huh.
I don't know, was that before your time?
It was a bit before my time. I don't know that much about it, but tell me, I'm very curious.
Well, this is what happened, and the man in Italy who published the book in English, Fettinelli or whatever, I'm very bad at names, somehow hired five people, and this translation was finished in a week, and he was the first and who produced English language Zhivago. And of course everybody expected that once he had achieved that and the enormous amount of money that it brought him, they would then take time to make a more literary translation. But this has not happened. We are still, the only way to read Dr. Zhivago, if you don't read Russian or French, is the very bad translations. But leading me up to say that I would like to think that your committee worries as much about quality as about the fate of the translators.
Well, we do worry about quality, but in many ways there are situations, because you see, as a translator, you have to work with the literary rights that are available. And if the gentleman that you are speaking of bought world English language rights to Dr. Zhivago and still retains control of those rights, then he is in a position where he can prevent anybody else from publishing a better translation. And that actually happens quite often. The case that I'm most familiar with is a novel by the great classic novel by the Cuban writer Alejo Carpentier, which was already in Spanish is called Siglo de las Luces, which means Century of Light, which is a title that 100 Years of Solitude very explicitly alludes to. But it ended up being translated into English from the French translation, not even from the original Spanish.
Yes, I know.
And it's called Explosion in a Cathedral.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with the original title.
I know all about this. I knew Carpentier when he was consul in Paris.
Oh, really? You knew Carpentier?
Yes. And it is a marvelous book, and I've been fulminating about that awful title. baffles me.
Well, no, it has to do with, I mean, literally Harold Bloom in his latest book about genius dedicated a chapter to Carpentier and protested violently in print about this translation. But there's nothing anyone can do because the publisher that owns World English Language Rights is not inclined to commission a new translation.
Why not?
I don't know. I mean, I guess if their current translation is still selling really well.
Well, there would be an enormous interest in a very beautiful translation of Zhivago, of course.
Well, it's something that I keep trying to convince people to do, but you have to understand that as a translator, you have your hands tied. You're not an original author who can just kind of go out and write what inspires you. You're working with a given text, and you have to make sure that you have the right to publish your work.
Yes.
Which you don't necessarily have in every case. It's very interesting. Actually, it's funny we should bring up Alejo Carpentier, because the most egregious thing that I've ever encountered in my career as a translator is something that's just happened within the last 3 months involving Carpentier, of all people. As you know, almost everything by him has been translated into English.
Yes.
But a dear friend of mine who is an urbanist and who is very much involved in the renewal of the city of Havana was in Havana and met with his widow, Liliana. And his widow mentioned that there was one essay by Carpentier, which is actually about the city of Havana, was written to accompany a book of photographs, and it's called Ciudad de Columnas, which is City of Columns, and it's never been translated into English. It never had been. It's only about a 12-page essay, but my friend came up with a rather gorgeous idea, given that this is the centennial, this year is the centennial of Carpentier's birth, of doing a book of lavish photographs of Havana, which is a very much photographed city right now, to accompany this essay by Carpentier, which would appear in English for the first time, all as a kind of tribute to him on his centennial. Terrific idea, right?
Yes.
And the publisher that we contacted was absolutely delighted with it, and everything was going swimmingly until the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which, as you know, is the division of the Treasury Department that regulates the embargo.
I know what you're going to say.
issued this very bizarre ruling, which had to do with Iranian electrical engineers, and they held that a journal which published articles by Iranian electrical engineers could not publish them if the articles had been edited or formatted in any way. In other words, they had to receive camera-ready copy from Iran in order to publish the articles. Well, it's obviously a decision that seems to imply that one cannot publish, certainly not, if one cannot edit or format, one certainly cannot translate material from any of the embargoed countries.
Right.
And although nobody has been actually prosecuted under this new ruling yet, all attempts to kind of seek clarification from OFAC have just led people further and further into a muddle, and a lot of publishers are, at this moment, as we speak, in the United States of America, afraid to publish, for example, an essay about the architecture of Havana by the greatest Cuban writer of this century, Alejo Carpentier. So that project is now on hold.
Oh, God, what a scandal.
Isn't it unbelievable?
Well, has the New York Times written
the New York Times actually did have an article about it, and just last week they had an editorial, actually, in the editorial column, saying how absurd this ruling was. I mean, it's absolutely in nobody's interest. In fact, the Treasury Department received a letter from Congressman Berman, who actually wrote the amendment to the embargo regulations that specifically exempts informational material. Berman himself wrote a letter to the Treasury Department saying, this new ruling has nothing to do with that law. I wrote that law. This goes completely against the spirit of the law. He couldn't have written a stronger letter.
But it's a political thing, this, of course. Not until recently, Cuban painters couldn't sell their paintings in the U.S. The music people have endless trouble.
But there's never been any. I mean, all of Alejo Carpentier has been translated. It all exists in English. There's never been any hint until now that there was any problem with publishing Cuban literature. Hundreds of books that originated in Cuba have, you know, my publisher themselves had earlier, before this ruling, published two books that originated in Cuba.
Yes, but in other fields of art, the United States, where money changes hands, Anyway, I don't want to go into that because our time is running out very soon. Tell me, how long this copyright of the English, for instance, Zhivago, for how long can this man sit on it?
Well, it depends. That's a tricky issue. It depends on, I guess since it originally came out in Italy, it would depend on Italy's...
copyright laws.
Italy's copyright laws, how they relate to international copyright laws. But generally, it's something like 70 years from the author's death.
Oh.
So it's quite long. And the tendency in the United States has been lately to extend copyright, which, of course, makes life much more difficult for us translators.
No, you're talking about original copyright now.
Which is
very long, but the copyright of a translation.
Oh, well, that completely depends on the contract,
yes.
You know, on the way that the contract was written, the original contract between the author and the publisher.
Right.
I mean, most writers nowadays will sell world English language rights for a specific period of time,
right.
After which it then reverts to the author. But I have no idea how that contract was written, and the fact that no new translation of Zhivago has appeared would suggest that
right.
It was rather advantageous to the publisher.
Okay, I have one more question before we have to stop, I think. I hope to let you come back some other time. There's so much more to say. The question is an American writer who is very much moved by an obscure, quote-unquote, novel he succeeds to reading in French or Spanish or whatever. What way would you point him to get it translated here?
Well, there are a variety of ways, and this is actually a spirit that at Penn we're very much trying to encourage among American writers, because there have been very powerful forces for bringing new work from outside of English into the country. For example, Susan Sontag single-handedly has brought in dozens of writers. One thinks of Philip Roth, for example, with so much work from Czechoslovakia that he promoted and from other parts of Eastern Europe at a certain point in his career. And it simply happens all too rarely nowadays that American writers think of their work, think of their role as import in addition to export, you know what I mean, as engaging
yes.
in a conversation with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But I think that an American writer who really loves a novel from French or Spanish should mention it to their own publisher right away. Publishers take the recommendations of the writers that they publish very seriously.
Yeah.
We also at Penn have started, our website is www.penn.org, and we actually have a page on that website which is called Penn Recommends for Translation, where our members can list books that they think should appear, currently available in English, whether they're now out of print or whether they were never translated. And it's quite startling, actually, how many books on that list, since we first posted it a couple of years ago, have since turned up in English. It's quite amazing.
No, that's lovely.
But the first thing to do would be to go to your own publisher and
yes.
say, look, I mean, I have a good friend named Francisco Goldman, who is part Guatemalan and an American novelist of some repute. And he has quite often recommended, he lives in Mexico City part of the year, and has quite often championed the careers of writers whose work he came to know in Mexico with some success, and has persuaded his publisher to bring out the works by these writers, and
right.
has really been a force for the good in that sense.
Esther, thank you very much for this, and we can all think about it and get back to it one day, I trust.
I hope so. It's
Many
been delightful.
Thanks. You have listened to a conversation with Esther Allen, who is the chairwoman of the Penn Translation Committee. I am Hans Koning, the novelist, and my program is called Literary Discord. It is initially heard on the fourth Thursday of each month at 12 noon and rebroadcast on the second Tuesday of the following month at 9:30 p.m. The producer is Scott Harris. Thanks for listening.